Magnum, we all saw the count 1, 2, 3.
I don't know what happened. He had him beat. I was up. Everything was great. Everything was going our way.
Dusty, you had him pinned 1, 2, 3, and then when you left the building, that should continue.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 61 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, I'm going back to a place that I haven't been to before, Jim Crockett Promotions, but in the year 1987. I covered shows from 86, which was one of their hottest periods, and 1988, when things were starting to get away from them in September of that year, just a few months before the Turner buyout. Here in 1987, well, obviously it's between those two periods, and the product is still very hot, probably a lot closer to 1986 in terms of where they were. There were some cracks in the foundation that were going to fester and really kind of rear its ugly head over the next year. As I'm recording this, it is Sunday night and WrestleMania 34 just wrapped up. I'm sure I'll touch on that, even though I don't know what percentage of the show I actually saw. But anyway, let me get in my plugs first. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown, on Twitter @GFAllentownPod. Give me a follow there. And you're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon for all your purchases, pain-free. You know the deal. You pay nothing extra, but there's a little bit kicked back by Amazon to Place to Be Nation to help with site costs. And earlier this week, I bought more Tim Hortons coffee, even though my wife didn't ordered me not to do it. But I went ahead and did it anyway, and I did the switch of the old can for the new can without saying anything, like when she wasn't home. So she'll just think that it was a, you know, twice as big of a can as it was before. She hasn't complained about the Tim Hortons in a week. But more importantly, I got my Village candle, the balsam fir that is burning right now in front of me at this very late hour. So it really does help me think. It is somewhat soothing because I have to admit, I'm in a rather foul mood. It doesn't really have much to do with WrestleMania so much, although maybe it does to a certain point. I obviously did not get to see all of it, which I'll get into that in a second because I have a whole thing about why I might be the worst wrestling fan there is. The TV theme that you heard at the top of the show was from One Day at a Time, which aired from 1975 to 1984 and really introduced Valerie Bertinelli, who I always want to call Valerie Burton Ernie because of that one reference on Family Guy years and years ago. And apparently there's been a reboot of One Day at a Time on Netflix, and literally nobody has told me of this in the last year, year and a half, or whenever it was that it came out. I'm kind of disappointed that nobody reached out to me and said that. Of course, oh, Pete, we didn't know you were a fan of One Day at a Time. I remember watching it as a young lad and having a crush on Valerie Bertinelli, despite the fact that she's about 20, 25 years older than me. Well, never mind. That is a show, One Day at a Time, that I think had to have been a favorite of Stephanie McMahon growing up, because there's a lot of slapping of other people, particularly by women, either slapping other women or slapping men. You had Barbara, who was Valerie Bertinelli, God, I almost said it, slapping her professor for coming on to her. You had the Anne Romano character there, Why would I forget Bonnie Franklin's name? Slapping the son that they brought in when Mackenzie Phillips was on too many drugs about halfway through the series. I feel like Stephanie, that series really sort of spoke to her. And speaking of Stephanie, with WrestleMania 34, I would say that I am the worst wrestling fan in the world because Friday night you had the Hall of Fame, which admittedly ran for a very long time. Instead, when I got home from picking my wife up at the airport, which I seem to do on a lot of Fridays, I chose to watch the Baltimore Orioles-New York Yankees baseball game that was on at the same time because I just didn't really feel the attachment to anybody who was going into the Hall of Fame, save for maybe Hillbilly Jim, which, and you weren't going to get a Vince McMahon laugh out of it. Because he's directed everything backstage. So I didn't watch that. I don't have a subscription to any of the other various streaming services, so I didn't see ROH Super Card of Honor anyway. Not that I was home at the time, as I missed NXT TakeOver to go to the Boston Bruins Ottawa Senators game, which the Bruins actually won, and I come back to find out that, oh, this was the greatest NXT TakeOver of all time. And I don't know if it's some sort of fatigue about that or if it's the fact that I feel bad that I'm not watching NXT on a regular basis anymore because I don't just feel that connection with any of the people who were there. Even though I love Andrade Cien Almas and he's probably my favorite guy there, I just can't get back into it for whatever reason. And now they're adding all these titles. I'm not a huge Adam Cole fan, but now you get a North American title now. I mean, before long, NXT is going to be adding like a Western States Heritage title to the mix, and then the whole thing just becomes very much like the main roster. So with all the reviews of Gargano versus Ciampa and some of the other matches, I'm probably going to have to cycle back to that at some point. And then tonight, I missed most of WrestleMania 34 at the abomination that was the Boston Bruins Florida Panthers game, the last NHL game of the season. The Bruins playing a team that has already been eliminated from playoff contention with a division title at stake and home ice advantage through the Eastern Conference playoffs, and the Bruins lose 4-2. And I lost my goddamn mind at the end of that game. And some woman comes over and is like, why don't you chill out? And I'm like, the last thing I need right now is some coming over to, tell me to chill out after I've been to 38 freaking home games. I've sunk a lot of time into that. And in fact, I got bored enough during the second period. And the Wi-Fi was surprisingly strong at TD Garden on Sunday night during a game that I was able to check out some of the WrestleMania card. I tuned in just in time to see Jinder Mahal pin Rusev. And on Rusev Day, of all days, I was kind of disappointed to see Jinder's weird-looking nipples go over in that match. But fortunately for me, the Ronda and Kurt Angle versus Triple H and Stephanie match was on next. And I came to realize something, that I appreciate the modern WWE product a lot more when I have it on mute. There's something about Michael Cole's voice, or even some of the other people. Like, I don't particularly care for face-fuck Todd Phillips either. There's just something about that guy. Like, the only play-by-play guy in WWE that I've liked in the last little while is Rich Brennan, who I kind of find out later that he was like a hockey play-by-play guy back in the day as well. So that was, kind of double kudos to him there. Mauro Ranallo is actually part of the reason why I just can't get back into NXT, because I watched that War Games that they did last November, and he said Mamma Mia like 13 friggin' times during the match. Like, okay, Mauro, we get it. Also, I get kind of irritated by Nigel McGuinness's voice, and then there's the third guy who never talks. I think his name is Percy Watson or whatever. See, this is why I'm a terrible fan. I mean, does this make me a terrible fan? I'm trying. I'm watching WrestleMania from the beginning on mute as I'm recording this, as The Miz goes for a pinfall attempt on Seth Rollins and kick out at two there. I listened to my friends at the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, their show that would have been not the last one as this one drops, but the one that would have come out on April 2nd. They were talking for the most part about WrestleMania 7, kind of just doing a rewatch review with some many humorous points that caused me to have to stop my run because I was laughing too hard. And they were making fun of the host, Mike Crockett, for being a bad wrestling fan, for not watching really anything. So that kind of did make me feel better in a way that, you know, maybe somebody is in the same boat as me. And I'm trying. I would watch Ring of Honor if I could figure out when the hell Nessun would actually televise it. I mean, why is it on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday unless a shop vac infomercial, like, interrupts it? But that's the New England Sports Network for you. The days of them televising the World Wrestling Federation from the Boston Garden are long, long over. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm just sad and jealous of all the members of Place to Be Nation who were down in New Orleans having what appeared to be an extremely alcohol-fueled time. I don't know how they were able to keep going. I'm seeing stuff at like 4:30 in the morning. It's like, yeah, I would have like passed out in a bar and people would have had to like carry me out of there and it just wouldn't have been good. Or I wouldn't have been able to get drunk. With me, there's really no in-between. So maybe next year in New York for me, it should coincide with about the end of the NHL season. And since I don't want to go to, you know, that to see them choke away either a playoff spot or a division title, which is 3 times in 6 years now that that's happened in the last home game of the season, maybe I'll take up an offer to head down to the Meadowlands. Although I checked hotels for next year, just Hilton hotels, and there were no rooms available. And there was one in Manhattan for like $680 a night, and no thank you on that. I have to admit, I'd rather stay like 45 minutes away up in, I don't know, White Plains, New York or something like that, and just kind of drive my way in. So I'm working on becoming a better fan, and hey, SummerSlam is just around the corner, and that is also in Brooklyn. Maybe I'll head down on the Saturday, maybe not for NXT, maybe I won't get to an actual show, but you know, if there's a Place to Be meetup for that, maybe I will make my way into that. So, took me long enough to get to back to 1987 Jim Crockett Promotions, still a very viable competitor to the World Wrestling Federation, although them having WrestleMania 3 and it being the big spectacle that it was going to put them way out in first place and just kind of make it very hard for them to ever be caught by any sort of competitor. In fact, it would take nearly a decade for that to happen. In this episode of NWA Worldwide from June 13th, 1987, which something else happened on that weekend, which I'll get into later. It's actually a fictional event. As I said, there were some signs, there were some cracks in the foundation that maybe weren't readily apparent at the time, but when you look back in retrospect, you go, huh, maybe we should have figured out that something wasn't right with what was going on there. You got Rick Rude walking out despite being one half of the tag team champions alongside Manny Fernandez, Raging and Ravishing. What a great tag team name that is. So he walks out and goes to the WWF in a Ravishing Rick Rude persona that people would come to know and love over the years. But when you lose your tag team champions like that, it just, you know, he walks out the door with the belt and all, it probably does not bode well for the future. They had closed the UWF sale, that whole deal, a few months before this. There's no mention of the UWF on this show. I just kind of am stating that as a sort of reminder of the fact that they shelled out all that money, or more accurately, Bill Watts was still owed that money. It was just kind of a liability on their books. Dusty Rhodes is still popular. He's still incredibly over, but Magnum TA had his accident some 8-9 months before this, and that was a huge blow to them because he is inarguably one of the top 2 or 3 baby faces in Jim Crockett Promotions. And his place does get taken somewhat by Barry Windham. But the thing is, Magnum had built himself up to that point. He had, you know, obviously the cage match with Tully at Starrcade 85, and Wyndham coming back just doesn't have that same history and connection with the people. And, you know, maybe given some time he could build it up, but it's not there at this time. You get the Great American Bash coming up in 1987. And I may have said this in the past, but it bears repeating, that this needed to be their try on pay-per-view. They had to get on to pay-per-view ASAP. Starrcade 86, that would have been a good time to try and do something like that, even if it was a regional pay-per-view. Just get some kind of foothold into that market where I don't think they understood the kind of revenue that they could have made from that. But the Great American Bash Tour, and the tape of the 87 Great American Bash is highlights from various shows, most famously the War Games, the first War Games, and then the second War Games as well. That first War Games, five-star match by most people. I really like the match, but I don't quite love it like everybody else does, and I think it might be some flaws in the psychology of the War Games matches. At least to me, some of them seem a little paint-by-numbers in terms of the, well, you get, you know, the heel versus the face in the beginning, and then obviously the heel is going to go in next because that's how you have to build it psychologically, because giving the baby faces a 2-on-1 edge doesn't really make sense from that perspective, and it leads to all the jokes of, well, has a baby face team ever won the coin toss? Apparently it happened in whatever TNA's version of this match was, which is so TNA, just thinking about it. But the promotion is still going good. There's still very hot crowds at the Bash, still a very hot crowd for the matches taped for this show, which includes a Dusty Rhodes-Tully Blanchard match in Greensboro that was taped on June 6th, so a week before this, with $100,000 at stake. Both sides had agreed to put up $50,000 with their seconds at ringside, holding on to the money in front of the people. There's a lot of heat there. Dusty Rhodes and Tully Blanchard, always a feud that they would return to. When researching Dusty and Tully, you have to be specific between, well, do you mean Dusty Tully 85, 86, 87, or that weird aborted one in 88 that led to the Midnight Rider angle because Tully got hit with a baseball bat by Dusty the day before the first Clash of the Champions. So there's a lot good going on in the promotion, so you're kind of willing to overlook certain things that are happening that might not be so good. Ric Flair's promos in 1987, I'm not sure if it is his strongest year as a promo guy just on weekly TV. We only get a very small glimpse of the Nature Boy on this show, which is very peculiar. We get a tag match later on with the other three members of the Horsemen, and I don't think Ric Flair is actually there. I did not, at least didn't note it in, you know, my notebook, my infamous notebook where I take 8 pages of notes per show that sometimes I have trouble reading, to be quite honest. That can happen from time to time. But Flair's promos during that time where he's going after Precious, and, you know, Precious comes out and slaps him at one point. And then when he loses the title to Ronnie Garvin, the series of promos he does when Garvin is the champion are some pretty legendary stuff to my mind. So, you know, just off the top of my head, if you say, all right, you go to a desert island, you can take 1 year of Ric Flair promos with you. What year? I'd probably say 87. And then I would say, you know what? That's a really fucking weird thing to say, what year of Ric Flair promos would you like to take to a desert island, considering there's probably not a VCR streaming service or any way that I could really watch this. Maybe I would be given some sort of device in order to make it happen. Also on this show, we got the Rock and Roll Express, who are the new tag team champions of the world for the NWA, as JCP had to scramble after the departure of Rick Rude. And where the Rock and Rolls are, the Midnight Express cannot be far behind, as they are they're the U.S. champions, and Jim Cornette is doing his famous intro of them. And I'd like to have a moment of silence for Jimmy Cornette, who I believe passed away when that 10-year-old won the tag team titles at WrestleMania the other night. As I said, I'm taping it right after WrestleMania, so I'm not sure if something's going to happen on the Raw between now and then, but I can't imagine Cornette watching it. I'm afraid to even see what he might have said on his Twitter account with regards to how that went down. So with all this in mind, and with apologies once again for being a terrible wrestling fan, why don't I just jump right into the show? One production element that they did on this show that they were not doing, at least in the 1986 episode that I covered, is they did a teaser at the top before the theme song played. Sort of like what I've been doing the last 20 episodes. Kind of took that from TV shows, but I like when wrestling shows would do that as well. Tease for the Tully Blanchard, Dusty Rhodes, $100,000 TV title match that, as I said, was in Greensboro on June 6th. And J.J. Dillon, of course, is holding the money for Tully's side. And Dusty brings to ringside Magnum T.A., who his car accident was the previous October. And he made a return to television in February, I believe it was, but a much more emotional return at the 1987 Crockett Cup, where Dusty and Nikita Koloff, the Superpowers, emerged victorious in that one. Magnum is walking around with a cane rather gingerly, and he says that he's holding the money right in the teaser.
Let there be no doubt, James J. Dillon. I got $100,000 here, and if you want it, you got to have your man beat the man in the middle of that square circle right now. So you just keep your hands off that money.
Couple of things I want to note on that is that Magnum kind of foreshadows some of the controversy with In This Ring, and also just listen to the crowd on that and just how unbelievably hot they are in Greensboro on that night. Little do they know that a few months from now, their precious Starcade would be taken away and given to the city of Chicago, who, yes, they came out in numbers on that Thanksgiving in 1987, but that was pretty much it, and it also really harmed Greensboro going forward, having it taken away from them. Our hosts are Tony Schiavone and David Crockett, and we get the little graphic on the screen, and you remember these that when it would say, in stereo, where available? I always liked those, because I never had like a stereo big setup in my house. There's not like a home theater or anything like that. I love the notion of the guy watching NWA Worldwide in 1987 who's got a big stereo setup so you can really hear the crowd, which I guess would, you know, enhance it because they are really excited about all of this. And they're talking about the show, and the focus is on this Dusty Rhodes Tully Blanchard match, which we are going to see, believe it or not, because they just seem to sort of be talking about it up front, is controversy. Dusty Rhodes swearing, as you heard him bleeped out. Money, bucks, everything's going on here. So who do we have walking into the picture but Dusty's dear friend, Barry Windham? And he happens along to kind of gives his thoughts. I always like when guys just show up in the interview area and then, you know, cut a quick promo. My favorite of that type was definitely,
hey, Hacksaw, have you seen Sapphire Baby? No, I haven't, Dust, but we're all still looking for her.
My theory on that is that Duggan was just trying to be nice because he was on his way to the John, but, you know, he's a baby face, so he's got to be nice to the other baby faces, at least when the camera is on. So Wyndham had given his thoughts, And he's a friend of Dusty, but he's not too good of a friend of Dusty. In a different world, he would have been the best friend and the number two babyface here, or even maybe the number one babyface. But he had left Dusty's side in Florida and all that when perhaps he was going to be groomed for that Magnum TA spot, shows up in the WWF in the U.S. Express with his brother-in-law, Mike Rotundo, and they have a nice run there. But the way Wyndham took off, kind of, you really feel like you maybe couldn't trust him holding $50,000 at ringside. So that's a good reason for why he might not be the guy there. So Dusty Rhodes versus Tully Blanchard is one of those great rivalries that perhaps, at least among a casual fan, gets overshadowed by Dusty versus Ric Flair, which is something Dusty and Flair had gone on for so long, going back all the way to Dusty calling out Flair in that weird interview at Starrcade 83, because Dusty's not on the first Starrcade. He just kind of has this bizarre segment where he's sitting in the back and challenges the winner of the Harley Race Ric Flair match for a future date, which would end up being Starrcade 84 the next year. They main event Starrcade 84 and 85, him and Flair. At the Bash, they do a title switch back and forth on that tour in the summer. And that's pretty much it, thankfully, because that feud was starting to become something along the lines of You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC, Hotel California, a lot of songs that I've just heard way too many times at this point. And so it was with Dusty and Flair, because they had done so many Dusty finishes with that, and you know, on the main show of the year, not to mention all the house shows where people were left feeling burned, which would be repeated with the Lex Luger-Ric Flair rivalry in the next couple of years. But Dusty and Tully is something that they would return to. Is Dusty Rhodes not a stupid man? Because he knew that with his number two babyface now incapacitated with the car accident, that he was going to have to stay in that slot for a little while longer. It does sound selfish, but you think about it, there's really nobody else they could have conceivably put in that spot. And after all, Ronnie Garvin is the world champion later in the year. And don't get me wrong, he was very much over with a certain segment of the NWA audience. It's just wasn't really enough, maybe, to justify the world title. It's just that there were not a lot of options available other than maybe Dr. Death Steve Williams would have made the most sense, because you had that UWF thing sitting right there where you could have that rivalry. But I don't want to distract from the Dusty Tully thing. And Dusty knew that Tully was the kind of guy that would bump all over the ring, stooging and this and that, and they could have very good matches with each other. Tully, in his shoot interviews famously, wasn't so fond of Dusty Rhodes. It's the famous 1988 interview with the Turner executives who were doing their due diligence on potentially buying the company. And Tully is like, screw Dusty, gets back to him. And there's a lot of hard feelings there going forward. These two always had good matches together. It's still obviously very hot here in 1987. But by the time you get to 1988, their rivalry consists of Dusty hitting him with a baseball bat before the Clash, as I said in the intro, and that Midnight Rider stuff, which certainly hastened the decline of Jim Crockett Promotions through the year 1988. But it is kind of, you know, I would say that the actual matches themselves are better than Dusty and Flair. It's just that all the greatest hits of Dusty Flair gets played in the historical perspective on the WWE Network, because let's face it, the WWE really doesn't give a crap about Tully Blanchard and has absolutely no reason to, you know, make a big deal out of his contributions to wrestling history. And Ric Flair, completely different. The money here for this match is both sides put up $50,000. And there was an actual difference in how the money was denominated for each side. Tully had it all in, I think it was $100 bills. So just doing the quick math there, that would be 500 $100 bills in probably those little stacks like you would see in movies and whatnot. And Dusty was doing the quote-unquote common people money. It was all 20s, 10s, and 1s, which, have to admit, is pretty good for money laundering. In fact, that would probably kind of raise some red flags. Maybe it's just my experience working in mutual funds and, you know, a greater emphasis in my job on money laundering and being a first line of defense and all that sort of stuff. So maybe Dusty, you know, having these kind of bills, I don't know. I'm just saying. And Tully, by contrast, probably had like unmarked bills or something like that. May have been traces on cocaine. Traces of cocaine on that money. I'm going to say that thing about how, oh, there's a trace of cocaine on 92% of all dollar bills. That is like the greatest urban legend ever, I think. So the $50,000 on Dusty's side is being held in a canvas bag. At first, I thought it was a paper bag. And then upon further inspection, looks to be one of those canvas bags that you would bring to the supermarket if you're one of those, well, I don't want to have plastic bags because I'm friendly for the environment, even though those plastic bags are perfect to put in your bathroom and around the house and basically, you know, multiple use sort of thing. It really does feel like it's not secure enough, though, compared with, say, a duffel bag, like what Bobby Heenan had at WrestleMania 1 that he then got back from Andre at the end of the day. There were some other options.
In the future, I would prefer a nondescript briefcase to the sack with a dollar sign on it.
Seems weird that in wrestling, where things tend to be a little bit more over the top than it should be, just because that's the way things are done, that you didn't get the sack with a dollar sign on it like you got in the cartoons. Anyway, so we get to our match here. And they're kind of doing a little stalling to let the tension build at the beginning, because, as I said, the crowd is just out of their minds for the 60-minute time limit, which Tony Schiavone points out is extremely long for a TV title match, as Blanchard had been used to defending in more of a 15-20-minute environment, which is customary for the TV title both then and into the 1990s, famously with Steve Regal and his, you know, stalling to get it to the 15-minute mark. And Dusty is very much in control early, gets a takedown, and then preens for the crowd, as only Dusty Rhodes could. Tully takes a powder and confers with James J. Dillon, Dark Journey, and Dark Journey's boobs on the outside. Now, Dark Journey, we met her back 40 episodes ago now in the UWF. Wow, it's been way too long since I've done a UWF show, but there are fewer of those on YouTube now than there were back then. Journey was someone who was in the UWF in 1986. She ended up managing a few people, Missing Link, a few others, feuding with Missy Hyatt, and Missy was not exactly a fan of working with Dark Journey because she was not really experienced in ring in any way. And here, she's with the Four Horsemen for a lot of their interviews in the late spring and early summer of 1987. She's fired around the end of the Bash time because it really had no sort of chemistry, where she is the quote-unquote executive secretary for Tully Blanchard Enterprises. I was like, Tully Blanchard, a man ahead of his time, self-incorporating rather than just being a man. Because even in 1987, there were tax advantages to incorporating oneself rather than being an individual. But I'm not going to bore you with those details. And Dusty reverses an Irish whip. It's a hip toss. And then shows the elbow. And Tully bails out of the ring again, just reminding me how great of a slimy heel Tully Blanchard is. I mean, in any discussion of great heels of the 1980s, obviously everybody starts with Ric Flair, and that's perfectly fine, but Tully Blanchard just underneath that, just from, you know, the, I don't know, it was so very easy to hate Tully Blanchard as opposed to Ric Flair, who is almost kind of the archetype years later for the cool heel. No rapper has ever made a rap song talking about Tully Blanchard, but they have about Ric Flair. That's kind of the difference between those two. Yeah, four elbows by Dusty. So he's laying it in pretty good here at the beginning. And Tully bails to the outside again. So that's three times he's done this in the first, I want to say, 8 to 10 minutes of this match. Now he's getting chopped in the corner. Dusty lays in the elbow to the top of the head. I don't know why I slapped my elbow on that. Maybe I've watched too many independent matches or whatever. Where I got to slap the body part in order to create the sound effect. And I'm waiting. I made my note here that I'm waiting on how is Tully going to turn the tide, because it seemed like a really long sequence where he's just getting his ass kicked in the beginning, and he gets a knee up in the corner where he doesn't break clean. But Dusty reverses another hip toss and gets one of his own, and then he starts working on the leg of Tully, locking in what appears to be like a spinning toe hold. He's not really spinning, though. It's just sort of a toe hold. And they go to an ad break, because this is a very long match for an NWA worldwide. Interestingly enough, when they come back from the ad break, instead of going right back to the match, they start promoting their upcoming show at the San Francisco Auditorium. Tony Schiavone there, July 7th. And I thought, it's really strange for them to start promoting it in the middle of a match. I know in the WWF, you would have Howard Finkel do the little voiceover while Dusty has the toehold on, letting us know that the NWA is coming to the blah, 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 blah. It would be done in that style. So it kind of reminds me to make the point of 1987 Jim Crockett Promotion. And this is another one of those things where there were some cracks under the surface that maybe a fan wouldn't ordinarily see, because you didn't get the schedule of these promotions published on the internet for all to view like you do now. There was recently some sort of lawsuit where WWE's entire schedule up through the next WrestleMania got published. And that happened before, and it tended to be very accurate. At least it got all the Boston shows correct, and I think most of the others as well. But Jim Crockett Promotions in 1987 was blowing through money at an alarming rate for various reasons. I mean, buying an airplane, or two airplanes, as I understand it. But also, having the boys travel all over the country, and this was a problem for the WWF in late 1984 when they expanded out and they hadn't quite figured out, hey, maybe we should do loops that are more regional instead of having guys fly from Edmonton to Atlanta and just all over hell. Let's just take a brief snippet of, since this San Francisco show was on July 7th, let's start at July 4th. They're doing a TV taping at the TBS studios, Techwood Studios in Atlanta on July 4th. Then on the 5th, actually there's a show at the Omni that night, so that actually makes sense. On the 5th, there are two shows, one in Greenville, South Carolina, which is a matinee, and then Charleston, West Virginia that night. Tully Blanchard is on both of those shows. So he's going from Greenville to Charleston, presumably on that plane. The next night, where are they? They are in Inglewood, California, at the Great Western Forum in Los Angeles. Tully Blanchard is there also against Dusty Rhodes. This is crazy. Then you have the July 7th show, the next day after that, in San Francisco. So you fly up the coast, so not too long of a trip there. And then on July 8th, they're back in Atlanta for another TV taping at Techwood Studios. And then beyond that, they're in Cincinnati on July 9th. So think of how you're traveling every which way, and it's going to wear down anybody very quickly. And it's not like they were in the practice of giving guys nights off on a frequent basis, or, hey, Tully, why don't you take a couple weeks off, rest your body, this and that. And there was nobody stepping aside due to injury, because that's just not the way things were done then. I mean, today, somebody suffers an arm injury, yeah, he'll miss a couple of shows and maybe just kind of make an appearance if they've been promoted for that show. But back then, no, he's going to go in there, and even if he just has to work a six-man match, that's what it's going to be. And on that San Francisco show is Arn Anderson versus Nikita Koloff for the U.S. title. As I said earlier, there's no heavy Ric Flair presence on this show, but they do make up for it by giving us two Arn Anderson promos, including this one on Nikita Koloff has more than a bit of truth to it.
You got to call a spade, Tony Giovanni. Nikita Koloff is as good as they say he is. He's been a great champion. He is a great champion. But the only problem you have that I see, Nikita, is you become domesticated. That little girl that lives with you says, no, Nikita, let's skip the gym today. Let's go lay out by the pool. Well, laying out by the pool ain't going to get it done against me. I'm going to show you why in San Francisco.
I am going to put aside the whole thing of, I believe he's referring to the woman that Nikita Koloff would eventually marry. She died of Hodgkin's disease in 1989. So I'm going to put that in the background because I know that Nikita was probably distracted by all that as he took a hiatus from wrestling. So I'm just going to focus on the wrestling part of it. It's like, yes, clearly Nikita did stop hitting the gym at a certain point, because when you look at him in 1988, flat top Nikita, there's something missing. Like, where's the rest of you, Nikita? Is something lacking? Maybe there was something going on in his personal life at that time, and he had other things to worry about, and that's understandable, but just watching it on TV would have had to strike somebody as weird, and somebody who would have seen this show and thought, like, huh, Arn Anderson, he always makes a good point, but he particularly made a good point in this case. As they come back from commercial, Dusty is still very much in control. And Tully Blanchard, you're not going to believe this, but he bails out of the ring again. And they're fighting at the barricade. Seems like a very 2000s sort of move here. And Dusty hits Tully with the cane of Magnum TA by the ring post. So I guess this is sort of a no DQ sort of situation, I guess. I don't know. Or maybe the back of the referee, Tommy Young, was turned. Figure four by Dusty inside the ring. Dusty would apply the figure four in sort of a weird way, almost kind of, not quite like the Hulk Hogan way, where he would not do the spinning toe hold and into the figure four, which is the classical way. But the way Dusty does it is perfectly fine. I mean, he gets the hold applied. As long as you get it applied, it really doesn't matter. Just think about it from a kayfabe perspective here. When you do the spinning toe hold thing to apply the figure four, you are opening yourself up to getting rolled into an inside cradle or whatever, just as Greg Valentine was at WrestleMania 4, just as Ric Flair has many times. You know, that can happen. So the way Dusty's applying it, he's not leaving himself open to that quite as much, and I'm sure he gave great thought to it over the years. Tully reaches the ropes almost right away on it, and you're not going to believe this, but Tully bails to the outside again, and Magnum gives him a nice little slap there, which to me kind of justifies certain things that the heels might be doing a bit later, because Magnum hit Tully, you know, it's just words, and then he slaps him, although it was kind of, he hit him with the left hand, and it wasn't exactly a full force. Dusty is out there, sends Tully into the barricade, and then locks on the figure four on the floor for some reason, probably because in the world of wrestling, moves have different levels of effectiveness, such as in the ring is one thing, but you can escalate it by doing the same move on the floor. And then you can further escalate it by doing it on a broadcast table. But back then, they didn't have the table at ringside to do that. So Dusty has to settle for a dirty cement floor that I can't imagine was power washed all that often. Tommy Young tries to sort of break it up, but to very little avail. But J.J. Dillon does with a stomp to Dusty. So I guess what's good for the goose is good for the gander. They've each gotten in a shot from the second, so things are back even. And Tully gets Dusty re-entering the ring, and he's working on the perpetually injured leg of Dusty Rhodes. Does this go all the way back to 1985 with the Horseman breaking Dusty's leg and causing hard times on Big Dust and his family? It seems like that's what they're going for, and the figure four is locked in by Tully. And Tony wonders why he didn't just go for the figure four like as soon as possible. It's like, whatever. He gets a two count out of it as the pinning combination, and Dusty struggles but eventually turns it over Blanchard gains the ropes almost right away after that. A very shitty-looking DDT by the American Dream, which Tony, I don't know what the hell was going on back in 87, but they were calling it the form of a bulldog instead of a DDT. I don't know if they had some sort of Jake Roberts hang-up or whatever as the big guy in the business who was using that move, but here in the NWA, they've already made it a kind of transition spot. Although eventually it would be used as a finisher. I think Jimmy Garvin and Michael Hayes used a double DDT when they were the Freebirds later on. Tully gets a knee up in the corner but gets caught coming off the second rope. Dusty ends up falling though, so selling the injured leg, and Tully works him over a little bit more, and they cut to Magnum TA. Some real concern on his face there. He's just kind of sitting in a chair at ringside, and his cane is one of the ones that has sort of the curved top, not like the candy cane type deal, but the one that's like curved, almost like a seven at the very top of it, and it's black. I don't know why I feel like I should give that much detail into Magnum TA's cane. Dusty comes back with some right hands and a headbutt, and he's wobbly, or he's kind of doing that flailing arm thing, but it's really, he's just doing that Bailey thing that she does from time to time. They are 15 minutes into the match here, and boy, am I running out of gas or something? Because this might be the longest match in Greetings from Allentown history, because I'm used to just these 2-3 minute squashes, but this is a very good bout. Tully sets up for a vertical suplex. Tony suggests that he's going for the slingshot now, but he's a little too far away from any of the ropes, and he'd have to carry Dusty over to wherever, so probably not. And in any event, Dusty ends up getting the suplex, but Tully kind of spins out of it, and they run the ropes, and there is a double crossbody spot. I feel like that would have been a good place for... There's nothing wrong with a good double clothesline to knock both guys down for a while. The double crossbody that they did, where they're kind of both diagonal and they run into each other, it looked like something of a botch. Maybe it was designed that way, with that in mind, to kind of give a sense of realism to it. I don't know. Dusty eventually pops up suddenly and scores with two elbows to Blanchard, who then misses a charge to the corner. Dream locks on the spinning toe hold, but a thumb to the eye breaks it for Tully. That'll stop an elephant, Monsoon. Then we see something that I don't think I've seen very often. Tully goes for a snap mare, and Dusty blocks it. I've never seen a block of a snap mare. It's usually just sort of a thing that happens. It's a transition move to a transition move. Dusty gets a backslide for two, so we're getting some near falls here. Atomic drop by Dream, and Magnum is shown smiling at ringside. He locks in a sleeper hold, but Tully gets to the ropes. And outside on the apron, Dusty suplexes Tully back into the ring, but in a slingshot fashion. So he's using Tully's own finisher. And this is where things start to go off the rails slightly. He's close to the ropes, and he goes for the pin. And you get 1, 2, 3. Tully puts his foot on the rope just after the three count. So Tully, he's lost the match as you're watching it, and the crowd goes ballistic over this. You know, Dream has won the $100,000, but the fact that it came after three is actually kind of important for what happens next here, which is they feel that they've won, the match is over now, but now Tommy Young, the referee, five-time referee of the year, Tommy Young, although I don't know where these awards may have come from. I tried looking it up. It was mentioned on Where the Big Boys Play many times in reference to Tommy Young's awards and where they might have come from. It's just something that they would refer to without any sort of attribution. I feel like you should get the little Wikipedia citation needed for the Tommy Young five-time referee of the year thing, because it actually is on his Wikipedia page and there's no real reference to it, like to him actually being presented with an award. So Dream thinks the match is over. Everybody thinks the match is over in there. And Tommy Young apparently just says, no, I see Tully's foot on the ropes, despite the fact that it came after the three count. So JJ and Dark Journey are up to no good on the outside. And Dark Journey gets in Magnum's face. I don't know if she thought that he was going to try to kiss her like he had done with Baby Doll. I think it was. He does not do it in this case because it's all a distraction ploy for JJ to sneak up and steal the money. And this is some quality stuff. Dylan takes the canvas bag of $50,000 and just beats it for the exit and runs all the way through the arena, presumably to a waiting car. I don't know who might have been driving, probably one of the horsemen, or I'm pretty sure that they had a driver or a handler. They probably have guys in each city to take care of these sort of business, you know, transactions. I mean, San Francisco, I there are a lot of shady characters maybe that they could hook up with who maybe for a small cut of that $50,000. So JJ's gone. Meanwhile, back in the ring, Tommy Young wants a restart. But Dusty, having seen the money get stolen from Magnum, who, by the way, couldn't do a damn thing about it because he's a man walking with a cane because he had a serious injury, Dusty runs after JJ and he gets counted out of the ring by Tommy Young when he didn't even know that the match was still going on. Apparently, Tommy Young never tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, whatever. So if Dream sticks around in kayfabe, he can still fight for that $50,000, and Dylan, you know, who's run off and stolen the money, let the NWA deal with it, because, you know, there's nothing more powerful and more effective than an NWA committee making decisions on things, especially somebody like Jim Crockett Jr., who we're actually going to hear from a little bit later talking about the finish here. Instead, he gets counted out of the ring, and Tully is ecstatic because he's won the match, dispatched Dusty Rhodes, seemingly for good, at least according to him, going forward. So this finish here, it's not exactly perfect. It's not well done. I am not sure if it was intended for Tully to get his foot on the ropes before the three count, but the foot hit the rope after the three count. So it's one of those things where you really feel sort of screwed by it. And you're playing off the emotion of Dark Journey and Dylan stole $50,000 from what is effectively a handicapped man at ringside. So that's some pretty good heel stuff there. However, why would you put Magnum TA in that spot, even if he's your best friend and you trust him that much? Just from a kayfabe perspective, have Barry Windham there because he's of able body and mind to guard the money. Or you could justify having a second person there on the grounds that, well, they have Dark Journey and J.J. Dillon. Why can't I have both Barry Windham and Magnum T.A. at ringside with me? And Dusty comes back to the ring. And this is very interesting for 1987. Is the Dream cuts a profanity-laced tirade of sorts that gets bleeped out. And the crowd isn't exactly sure what to make of this.
Crockett! Crockett! Jim Crockett! I want my money! The money's mine! Jim Crockett! You get my money from right now!
It is a little strange to hear a guy in 1987 cursing that openly, even though it's bleeped. It was a different time back then. I mean, it's not exactly like the 50s where you couldn't say pants on television or anything like that, or when Ed Sullivan wouldn't let, you know, Elvis, show Elvis below the waist or any of that stuff. But it does strike me as kind of unusual, although 10 years later with Austin, it would just be commonplace with middle fingers and not F-bombs by any means, but, you know, cursing on TV that would be edited out of certain programming. So when I come back, I'm going to take a quick break here. We're going to go to the back where Tony Schiavone is with Dusty Rhodes, Magnum TA, and then we'll also hear from Tommy Young.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Sorry, I lost the money. I'm sorry.
Hey, don't worry about the money. Don't worry about the money.
Look, I'll do something. I'll get the money back, all right?
You're in no shape to get the money back. You know what I mean? You know, I get out of here. Get out of here.
Jesus. As they go back, Tony was looking for Tommy Young and hadn't gotten to him yet. So he's in the locker room there. And Dusty comes back. Magnum's already back there. So Dusty comes storming in, cursing a blue streak, which is the intro that I played at the top of the show. Anyway, I had a recent blooper on one of the shows where I played a different intro than the one that I referred to during the show. Kind of a continuity error. I feel like I'm making movies here or something like that. So anyway, it's a very emotional scene, almost very cinematic. It feels like something you would have seen from like the end of Act 2 of a movie where Dusty gives Magnum a hug. After that little scene there where Magnum is so apologetic because there was nothing he could do in his physical state to really stop JJ from running off with the money. And it kind of is the end of Act 2, at least of this part of the Dusty and Tully story from that particular year, because later on they would go and have a rematch at the Great American Bash in a match that kind of... It's definitely one that, oh my God, they had a barbed wire ladder match, and people are like, oh, and then it turned out to not really be all that great, as it turned out, all things considered. The crowd heat was not there for that match the way it was for this one. The other thing is the Bash 87. Why is this not on the network? Could somebody explain this to me? And it's not something in a Google search that you could, like, why is Great American Bash 1987 not on the network? Because you think it would just be up there like the rest of the Crockett library. They have other stuff up there that wasn't necessarily pay-per-views under the pay-per-view section. I'm looking at you, Royal Rumble 1988. So eventually, Tony Schiavone does get to talk to Tommy Young, so he can give his side of the story. Now, you'd think, looking at this, that is Tommy Young turning heel here? No, it doesn't really seem that way, and as it turned out, they would kind of quickly sort of forget about this, despite Jim Crockett Jr. coming along later and saying, yeah, he's not going to be refereeing any more Dusty Rhodes matches for a while, kind of like how Ben Dreith, the referee who screwed the 1976 Patriots on a roughing the passer call, never did a Patriots game again for the last, I want to say, 8 or 9 years in his career. I'm thinking of, like, bad ref calls, like how NHL referee Andy Van Halen, and actually, I think I was referring to this with Jesse Ledoux, talking about the Quebec Nordiques and how Andy Van Halen screwed the Nordiques against the New York Rangers. And I think it was game 4 of the 95 playoffs, and the league, it was so egregious, they sent him to an early retirement as a result. Was this bad enough to send Tommy Young to an early retirement? Probably not, although he unfortunately did end up retiring a lot earlier than he would have based on an injury he suffered in a 1989 match between Mike Rotundo and Tommy Rich. So I'm going to let Tommy Young speak his piece here, because it's kind of interesting to actually hear him, you know, talk on a wrestling show.
Well, okay, yes, I went 1, 2, 3 on telly. You saw that. That happened, okay.
That's right. And then all of a sudden you say, come back in the ring, and Dusty's outside.
Well, because of that, I mean, when Dusty cleared my vision, there's his leg over the rope. Hey, we're talking about the National Wrestling Alliance television title. We're talking about $100,000. That's a lot. I have to be sure. Now, I'm 5-time referee of the year. I call him as I saw him, and that's the way I called that one.
Well, we want you to see it one more time, and all the fans take a look at exactly what everyone saw.
That's okay.
So at this point, they show him the replay of the finish with the foot on the rope that clearly came after the three count. By the way, I love how Tommy Young throws in the I'm the five-time referee of the year thing again, which it's like, give me a freaking break here. This must be an award that they only gave in the 80s, because it's not like Mike Chioda has won any referee awards in recent years. Has the Observer, I don't think they give out a referee of the year award. God knows they give one out for all other manner of nonsense in wrestling. I mean, you know, why not referee of the year? Why not worst referee of the year? You know, these people are so nameless now on WWE broadcasts, except for Charles Robinson. Basically, the guys that we knew from back when. Like, I couldn't name more than a handful of officials now. So they show Tommy the replay, and it's hilarious, his response after seeing it.
All right. I realize that, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry to you, to Mr. Crockett, to Mr. Rhodes. But you just have to understand that in a situation like this, hey, we don't use instant replays in professional wrestling. That's only done in football, and even it causes controversy there. Now, I'm sorry, but I call it as I saw it. That's the decision I made, and as far as I'm concerned, that's the final decision. I'm going to stand by that decision.
So yeah, Tommy Young is not exactly covering himself in glory here, because he sees the whole thing, he sees that he screws up, he kind of admits it, and then at the end he's like, you know what, I stand by my call anyway, which is literally the most infuriating thing a guy could do. I don't know if you recall, I think it was the year 2010, Armando Galarraga of the Detroit Tigers was one out away from a perfect game. Ground ball to first base. First baseman underhands it to Galarraga. Runner is called safe, even though he was clearly out, by umpire Jim Joyce, who later admitted that he was wrong after the fact. And everybody celebrated Jim Joyce for the fact that he was a stand-up guy in the aftermath, admitted his mistake very publicly. I mean, that's about as bad of an error you could make as an official. I think Galarraga deserves even more credit for just not losing his freaking mind at that, because he was... There's only been 20 guys or so in baseball history have thrown perfect games, and Armando Galarraga is not a guy whose career was going to last very long. So if he had pitched a perfect game, he would have been part of a very exclusive club. So Tommy Young's response to all this is not a good one, and I don't think they were really going anywhere with a storyline. I think even Mike Crockett of the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing would admit that he made a mistake if this is complete shoot and kayfabe and all that. You know, he would have looked at the replay and said, yeah, he did have his foot on the rope after the three count, so it is a legitimate win by Dusty. And then turned to Jim Crockett Jr. and said, Pa? Oh, wait, they're not related, Jim Crockett Jr. and Mike Crockett, but can we do something about this? Because I clearly made an error, and there's money on the line, and one side stole the money, like literally ran off with it. He's like Billy Joe and Bobby Sue from Take the Money and Run. That's what J.J. Dillon is at the end here. I wish we could have gotten a little something better out of Tommy Young as a result of this. Instead, we just had to wait 30 years for that ridiculous What Happened When meme that they've come up with. I think this kind of goes back to the importance of having a neutral NWA official hold the money, although I'm not sure I would trust Bob Geigel with a sack of cash. You know, maybe he could have flown him in for that. Maybe if there's a VIG. I mean, when you make a bet in Vegas, is a 5% VIG. So, okay, each side puts up 50 grand. They have to pay, I don't know, let's say $1,000 to the guy holding the money. So he gets 2 grand just to sit there and hold the money and then give it to the winner. And it's not going to get stolen by either side. So lesson learned there from the NWA. Clearly they would never make this mistake again. Right? It's really all kind of absurd to me, the way this went down. But Dusty would eventually get his revenge at the Bash, and Tully would get his, but really he would carry on and just team up with Arn Anderson later in the year and become the World Tag Team Champions. However, at the end of the day, the emotions that you're toying with Magnum there and having him in that spot, you played on that emotion already at the Crockett Cup by having him come out, and you have Nikita and Dusty win, and that's a happy ending. You have to be very, very careful if you're going to make the guy who is not necessarily crippled, but severely limited by his car crash, you're going to make him look bad in this situation as part of a storyline.
Play Simi Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryWrestling.com, and Scott Geed's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
There is a similarity between what is happening next and what was happening in the episode that I did of NWA Worldwide from September of 1988, where I was constantly complaining about how Dusty was inserting himself into everything. That was not purely a 1988 phenomenon. It was happening before, where other baby faces would talk about what was going on in the life of Virgil Reynolds. And so it is here with Jimmy Garvin, who is with Precious. And 1987 is as good a year for Jimmy Garvin, I think, as he would ever have. Because, yeah, he would go on to become the annoying Freebird later on in 91 and 92. Yeah. He was very annoying. Many time Billy Graham Award winner on Where the Big Boys Play. And it was shocking to listen to the Where the Big Boys Play podcast from Great American Bash 1988 and hear Parv, who hated Jimmy Garvin so much, I've probably heard 2.5 hours of audio just of him bashing Jimmy Garvin in his work later on, praising Jimmy Garvin for his match at the Bash against Ric Flair, at least the one that made the tape. The famous one that Rick won to win a night with Precious. And this is the year of that feud and the great promos of Flair, you know, trying to woo Precious. And she slaps him and Jimmy Garvin's all upset. And then we get Ronnie Garvin entering the picture. And before you know it, he's the world champion. But put Flair aside for now, because he's got to express his indignation about how Dusty got screwed.
There's no doubt in my mind, Bob, that I'm upset, and I feel the same way about it as the American Dream, the Rock and Roll Express, Barry Windham, my brother Ronnie Garvin, the Hands of Stone. The whole thing is a bunch of baloney. What were they thinking? They weren't. Obviously, they weren't. If the Four Horsemen think for 1 minute that they can come out there and steal the people's money, they're in for a big surprise, Bob. I mean, that enough is enough.
Ah, but is it time for a change, Jimmy Garvin? But it was actually a very good, passionate promo by him as he kind of goes on the Horsemen later on, not so much on Flair. I did like how he managed to name every consequential babyface in the company. Make sure you mention Barry Windham. Make sure you mention the Rock and Rolls. Let me get a smash cut to Ric Flair. And as I said, Flair in 87, in my head, was this legendary thing pre-network, pre-YouTube, that Well, clearly Ric Flair cut all these great promos for the Ronnie Garvin feud because that's how it had to be justified, is the fact that Flair was cutting all these great promos. The notion of Jimmy Garvin and Ronnie Garvin being brothers, I always think of them as, you know, there's the phrase, brother from a different mother. I believe he's also a brother from a different father as well, because those two guys look and sound nothing alike. So it's Ric Flair in 1987, so I'm going to play it.
Please sit down and take a look at what's really causing all this. The world's heavyweight wrestling champion.
And they go into a montage set to Ric Flair's theme, which is good. It follows in the footsteps of Mid-South and, you know, the music videos they would do to promote guys. And who better to promote than your charismatic world heavyweight champion? It's done, you know, it's really, really well done. But because it's Jim Crockett Promotions, they've always got to screw, like, one little detail up. There's always got to be something, like some mundane detail that they're going to just completely ruin it with. Maybe not completely ruin it, but so they play through this video, the Flair's greatest hits, this and that, set to his music, and at the end, they put a little chyron at the bottom of the screen that says, coming to an arena in your area. It's like, why did you have to put that on there? You're implying that by, like, saying, you know, I mean, come on. Did you have to do that? It's just like that stupid video from 1988 where they play a music montage for 50 seconds that I think included guys who had quit the promotion, like Nikita Koloff, but whatever, I'll forgive that because you had to produce it ahead of time. And then at the end, you have an idiotic catchphrase like, catch the pinfalls. That's what they had. Ric Flair coming to an arena near you. I know they're traveling all over hell, but it just struck me as weird. I laughed my ass off at that.
June 14th, 1987. Mets, Phillies, we're enjoying a beautiful afternoon in the right field stands when a crucial Hernandez error opens the door to a 5-run Phillies ninth, cost the Mets the game.
Our day was ruined. There was a lot of people, you know, they're waiting by the players' parking lot. Now, we're coming down the ramp. Newman was in front of me. Hernandez was coming toward us. As he passes us, Newman turns and says, nice game, pretty boy. Hernandez continued past us up the ramp.
Then, a second later, something happened that changed us in a very deep and profound way from that day forward.
It wasn't.
He spit on us. And I screamed out, I'm it!
Then I turned and the spit ricocheted off him and it hit me.
One of the great moments of the Seinfeld universe happened on this weekend. The Mets and Phillies game where Kramer and Newman got spit on by Keith Hernandez and Roger McDowell, or just one of them. I forget exactly how it shook out, but in reality, both the Mets and the Phillies played separate opponents that day, and each of them won, and Keith Hernandez actually hit a home run on June 14th, 1987, and no, he did not commit an error. Anyway, Jim Crockett is with Tony Schiavone, and Tony has his glasses on, which is a little unusual. I don't remember Tony with glasses all that much, but they're talking about July 4th at the Omni, this thing called War Games, but I'm much more interested in thinking about how the Omni had one of the weirdest roofs of any arena. It was basically like when you open an egg crate and you take all the eggs out, that's pretty much what the Omni's roof looked like. I'm not sure how good that was for water drainage, but hey, I mean, the building was only standing for about 25 years before they knocked it down. So who better than the charismatic Jim Crockett Jr. to explain to us exactly what is War Games and what is the match beyond?
There'll be two rings surrounded by a cage, one cage around both rings, and then a top put on the cage. No way in, no way out, except through the doors. There'll be 10 participants in it, but before the match beyond can begin, we're going to have the War Games. We start with 5 contestants on each side, the captain of each team, and each team is Dusty Rhodes, Nikita Koloff, the Road Warriors, and Paul Ellering. against the Four Horsemen and James J. Dillon. The captains pick who start. They wrestle for 5 minutes. At the end of 5 minutes, a contestant who will be decided by a coin toss enters. So you'll have two on one. 2 minutes later, a man from the other side. 2 minutes later, a man, until all 10 contestants are in the ring. And then the match beyond begins, and they wrestle until one man on one team either surrenders or submits.
That is quite a long time for Jimmy Crockett to be talking all at once, explaining the rules of the war games, which may be a little bit convoluted. The coin toss thing, as I said, can be a little paint by numbers because you're always going to have one side winning it, because otherwise, you know, the psychology of the match is completely screwed up. I mean, you know, contrast it with Elimination Chamber, WWE's answer to it, where you can put singles in the match rather than having teams. I just think back to that 2015 one where everything just got completely screwed up. The Mid-Carter Elimination Chamber with Dolph Ziggler and all that, and Mark Henry's one busting open by accident, and then he enters the match. I'm laughing thinking of that, but it's the exact opposite of what I would have wanted in that type of match, because I want a guy to get stuck like Derek in in Spinal Tap when they can't get him out of the thing during the show. This is also where Crockett says that Tommy Young's not going to be allowed to referee Dusty matches for a while until an investigation is completed, which I'm pretty sure didn't take too long because he was back as normal not too long after this. It was interesting that they didn't mention anything about Tully or the Horseman, but hey, you know, that's whatever. So coming up next, you got the Rock and Roll Express, the new NWA Tag Team Champions, taking on Gene Ligon and Tommy Angel.
Here's the angel, dear the angel, it's my angel, no one else is next to the ranks.
Well, we are going to see the angel here, because Ligon doesn't even get tagged into the match at all. It's one of those classic NWA squash matches that lasts 30 seconds, and I just get really annoyed by it. Ligon was a longtime enhancement guy, so it's not like he was just a guy to stand on the apron like his name was Nicholas or something. He said he loved working against the Rock and Roll Express in an interview that I saw, which, who can argue? He just had to stand on the apron for this one, and he got a paycheck. He also performed under a mask as Thunderfoot Number 2. And we all know that sequels can sometimes be lacking compared to the original. So they're the new tag team champions. They had them get them off raging and ravishing because Rick Rude just up and left. And he goes to the WWF, and he's on house shows for quite a while. He debuted in early to mid-June, so around this time, they announced the change the week before, repurposing footage of a previous match, saying that it was a title match. So, kind of interesting the way they did that. I mean, under duress, I mean, I guess that's as good as you could have done, considering the circumstances and a guy just sort of walking out the door and really sort of burning a bridge. Now, Rude's kind of lucky that JCP went under so that he would have a place to go back to after he walked out on the WWF in late 1990, although it would take about a year because of various contractual situations like a non-compete and all that. But one thing to notice here is when the Rock and Rolls come to the ring, only Robert Gibson has the belt. So there's only one belt between the two of them, as Morton is got nothing with him. And it's just a quick back elbow by Gibson on Angel and a double drop kick to end the match. But there is actually one thing notable here is Tommy Young, once again, our referee, he's just all over this show. And he's in the wrong position after the double drop kick. And I have to confess, despite the fact that Dusty versus Tully was, you know, kind of the main part of this show, I mean, it took up more than half of it, and I had to speak of it for so long that I had to take a break during it. Tommy Young, to get in position to count the fall, he jumps over, and he flies through the air, and he's got his arm in the position to count one as he's coming down. And when they go to commercial, they freeze with him in that position, like in midair, like a magic loogie. And I'm laughing my ass off. I'm like, I have to do this show just for the Tommy Young flying through the air thing. The boy wants to work. He's now facing a possible suspension. He can't work Dusty matches, so that means no main events. The boy wants to work, but just freezing him in midair as they go to the commercial break, it reminds me of that great sitcom, or really TV trope, that I love, where you get to the end of the A-Team or the Chips episode, and then they just freeze on the two people at the end as the credits start to roll. I like that, and I also like when they show highlights at the end of the show.
Nikita Koloff against Arn Anderson.
Tony, man, I hear Arn Anderson come on here and talk about Nikita Koloff, woman.
I swear to God that Nikita Koloff in that promo makes less sense than my cat does. I think my cat can cut a better promo than what Nikita just did there. I mean, yeah, you got the Russian gimmick, all right? You hew to kayfabe, you change your name and everything. But, you know, now you're becoming Americanized as a babyface. You can talk normally now. You're a guy from Minnesota. You know, cut the shit, right? The promo right before that was a Robert Gibson promo, which was way better. I mean, Robert Gibson cut a way better promo than this. So now I'm wondering, did Nikita Koloff, was he like speaking in tongues? Like, if I play it backwards, is it going to say Paul is dead? I might be crazy, but I think that that was a better promo than Nikita talking from start to finish. You just start playing him from the end backwards to the beginning, and it makes just as much sense, but it's infinitely more entertaining.
Ladies and gentlemen, the sports heroes for all of America's youth, beautiful Bobby and Sweet Stan, the Midnight Express.
So we've seen the new World Tag Team Champions. So we're going to get a look at the United States Tag Team Champions in the form of the Midnight Express, beautiful Bobby and Sweet Stan. As Dennis Condrey had walked out the door to somewhere else for a little while, would reemerge in about 18 months to start that feud, but that's for another time. They are taking on Vernon Deaton and Unknown. And why can't they just name these guys? It literally takes 2 seconds. Like, we care. We care who these people are. We want to track these. Anyway, whatever. So the Midnights lost in the semifinals of the Crockett Cup in 87 to Nikita and Dusty. So there's really no way you were going to go over that buzzsaw. Fun fact about the whole Crockett Cup and the naming of it. It actually was not even the original Crockett Cup that was named after Jim Crockett Sr. There was one before that given to the champions of the Southern Hockey League from 1973 through 77, which was actually the first all-Southern Hockey League in the United States. You had teams in Tampa, where there's a thriving NHL team that's been there for 25 years now. A team in Greensboro, where the Carolina Hurricanes set up shop for a couple of years in the 90s. And it looked like, just kind of investigating the Southern Hockey League, some crazy stories from that. Maybe there's a book out there on some of the things that were going on in the mid-70s. Probably a real slapshot feel to it. Now, this sounds like something out of the bullshit game, where there was an original Crockett Cup that was given to a hockey champion, but trust me, that is actually true. I'm not making that up out of thin air or anything like that. So as to the match, you had some kicks by the very educated feet of Sweet Stan Lane. Not sure where they went to school, because I don't have Jim Ross there to tell me about it. And Jim Cornette, this is again another quick squash match that's over before you know it. And Eaton doesn't even get into the match until you get the rocket launcher for the finish. And he actually pins the jobber with his pinky finger. He goes for a normal pin and then backs up at one. The referee kind of doesn't know what to do. And Eaton just kind of puts one pinky finger on the guy and gets the pin that way. And Cornette's commentary is infinitely more entertaining than anything else you could get, really, in this type of spot.
And here he comes.
You know something, David? I just want to show you the Rock and Roll Express's worst nightmare. When they won the World Tag Team title, they were rejoicing, they were laughing, they were singing, and all of a sudden, like a bolt out of the blue, it hit them. Oh, my God! We've got to defend against the Midnight Express, and that terrified them because they know that the rocket launcher is in their future. Rock and Roll Express, you've got to defend against these men, and when you do, those belts in China are going to be about the same distance away from you.
If you're going to make a case for Jim Cornette as the greatest manager of all time, I think a lot of it is predicated on the fact that not only would he bring his guys to the ring, he would also ring announce them, which some managers would do, but he would also find his way to the commentary table and call their matches as well while he was managing. So I think that's kind of maybe an edge over, say, a Bobby Heenan that you may want to consider there. I do think that as they are the U.S. Tag Team Champions, it's just a reminder how useless those belts are. I mean, they didn't need the U.S. Tag Team titles. I mean, they're there just as a challenger, a legitimate challenger to the Rock and Roll Express, as Cornette was saying. There's no need for a U.S. tag title to just kind of, you know, make them feel good. We know what the Midnight Express are, and that's a couple of badass dudes with a manager who really likes Wendy's and Arby's or A&W, whatever. Speaking of badasses, we're going to roll right into the last match here. Three of the Four Horsemen, no, not Ric Flair, Lex Luger, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, taking on, here we go again, Ricky Nelson and two unknowns. Could you at least put the unknowns under masks, please? Because that would make them somewhat interesting. You could make up names for them, but hey, you know, whatever. I guess there's somebody in the YouTube comments who actually did identify who these people are. This is not the Ricky Nelson, the singer that my father so loved. He had a VHS tape when I was younger called, I think it was a TV movie called Rick Nelson, A Brother Remembered. And my mother used to like ridicule my dad's love of Rick Nelson because, you know, he had some issues. And she would call the tape Rick Nelson, A Druggie Remembered. And it would make my father like just sulk for a little while every time my mother would say that. Rick Nelson, A Druggie Remembered. And this is another one of those deals where you got the three guys and they're each going to get in their one move. So it's interesting to see what it is that they choose and what order they go in. It's really all fait accompli. Lex starts out with a back elbow. Then you get a knee drop decapitation by Tully, which, boy, that looked like a pretty sick move. Probably a little hard to pull off to be a regular finisher for a team. And then Arn comes in for the ninth inning and scores with the Gourd Buster. This is all just immaterial stuff here. I mean, you know, the match is secondary to the promo on NWA. And 87 horsemen as they go into this. I find that they are a little overlooked because you have three sets of horsemen in the 80s. We're not going to count like the one at the very end of 89 with Sting because nobody really counts. I'm talking 86, 87, 88. 86, people love that because it's Ole Anderson. It's the original group. They had one of the longer runs. I think it might be the longest out of all the horsemen because right after Starrcade 85 and then right up to about January of 87. So almost the whole year of 86. Then you have the one that was inducted into the Hall of Fame, which was Tully, Arn, Flair, and Barry Windham. The thing that you always have to consider with that is Windham doesn't join until the middle of April in 88, and Arn and Tully are gone by September. So it's less than 6 months that those guys are together. So not really long enough to have enough of a quality run. I mean, even the Shield, that was a good year and a half or whatever. So you got to give it a little bit time to breathe. 87, I find, is a little bit overlooked. And I think some of it has to do with Lex Luger, and people seem to have complex feelings about Luger, not even just after the whole Elizabeth thing in 2003. I'm talking like even back then, having this musclehead come in with a big contract from Florida. It's just kind of, he also, at the end of the day, his break with the Horsemen was better than Ole Anderson's was. As Ole takes time off, goes to see his kid wrestle, and that's all well and good. I mean, those are legitimate reasons in reality to do that, but Luger's split is turned into a storyline where he and Windham are now chasing Arn and Tully. Culminates at Clash 1, then Windham turns, and Luger turns his attention to Ric Flair. So that one worked out. So they had a better split. And the run in 87, you have the War Games matches, which I suppose you could argue that you could have subbed in anybody in place of Luger. I mean, there's not a lot of memorable Luger moments from any of those 87 War Games matches. But he gives them sort of a different feel as more of a muscle guy in the group. Yeah, Arn is the enforcer, but it's nice to have a guy who can, you know, bench a lot, I guess. I don't know. So JJ starts out saying that Tully will not be facing Dusty again. Although he would be proven wrong at that Bash match. They actually got the NWA to put up the Horseman's side of the $50,000 in storyline. So there was some chicanery done there. And Tully, when he gets to talk, he makes actually a very good point. It's basically play it to the end. As Dusty wasn't paying attention, he lost his focus and then ran off after JJ and just left time on the clock for Tully to emerge victorious. And that's fine. Lex Luger says his piece. There's really nothing interesting there. He says nothing funny or doesn't mispronounce anything. But finally, Arn Anderson has the hammer here, as he should be when Flair is excluded from the group. He also makes a very good point about wins and losses.
David Crockett, what the problem is it's a snowball effect. It's what's going on. We're the people that said we don't care about public opinion. Dusty Rhodes is the man that had the tearful grandstand play. He brought his friend, Magnum T.A., handed him the money, set him down. It made my heart feel good. We know Magnum is a heck of a man, a heck of an athlete. I'm glad to see him come back. But if we're going to finalize this whole situation, David Crockett, let's put it in its proper perspective. This whole situation, I'm talking professional wrestling, is based on human error. If everybody was perfect, everybody was even, there'd be no winners, there'd be no losers. The bottom line is, we've cut our losses down. We've cut the chances of making a mistake down. That's why we win more than we lose. Now, Dusty Rhodes, you're a contender for everything this world has to offer, but you're a champion at nothing simply because you had a mental lapse. Blame it on yourself. Don't blame it on us. The better man won. In closing, I want to say one thing. You said it yourself. Magnum said, Dusty, I'll get the money back. Dusty, you said you're in no shape to get it back. Just like Rose is in no shape, like the Rock and Roll Express, the garbage, nobody's in shape to get in bed with the Four Horsemen. That's it right here. Horsemen.
Fellas, look, I gotta go.
Thanks, Jerry, because it was a little weird how the Horsemen sort of had a pep rally there at the end. Very, very sort of baby-faced with the chanting. But hey, you know, the Horsemen were still very popular with a certain segment of the audience, and they could still plausibly be presented as such. And they pretty much close out the show there, but we get the closing credits on NWA Worldwide with producer Virgil Runnels. never fails to make me laugh when I see that. They're showing Dusty lay the slingshot on Tully from earlier in the show, which is kind of funny to see that as his name is rolling as the producer. Klondike Bill was on the lighting on this one, so leave that at that. I just want to report that information. And that's how they wrap for NWA Worldwide, June 13th, 1987. But first, in lieu of YouTube comment theater, with the NHL playoffs starting tonight as I record this, so this show's dropping on Thursday, but there'll be three games played, but trust me, I'm recording this before those three games are being played. Probably, you'll be able to figure it out by how wrong some of these picks are. So, just a quick primer of the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. I'm going to start in the Western Conference, and Los Angeles Kings versus the Vegas Golden Knights. I think that the Kings are a huge sleeper in the West. A lot of, like, the advanced metrics really seem to favor them, and even though they are a quote-unquote wild card team here, I could easily see them coming out of the West. All the talk is about Nashville and Winnipeg and maybe even Vegas, but I like LA to prevail in six over the Golden Knights. In an all-California matchup between Anaheim and the San Jose Sharks, and the Sharks still do not have Joe Thornton back. I love Joe Thornton. He was a Bruin for 7 years. He's the same age as me. Not many guys in the league like that left. I like Anaheim to prevail there in seven games. Nashville taking on Colorado. Nathan MacKinnon basically put the Avalanche on his back and carried them to the playoffs, getting them in on the last day of the season with a win over the St. Louis Blues. But Nashville is just too much. I mean, they lost in the finals last year. They are primed and ready. They know what it takes. They have the defensemen to shut down MacKinnon. I like Nashville in five there. I think Colorado will pick up a win in one of the home games. Minnesota Wild taking on the Winnipeg Jets. And there is no Ryan Suter for the Minnesota Wild, so they'll be missing their best defenseman. But, there is precedent for teams upsetting another without their best player. The first one that immediately comes to mind is Pierre Turgeon in 93, the Islanders, when they upset the Pittsburgh Penguins. And mainly because I judge a lot of the Western teams by the games against the Bruins. Winnipeg is a, you know, hard team to play against, but in the game in Winnipeg, they were a bunch of friggin' cheap shot artists, so screw them. I'm picking Minnesota in 7 to upset the Winnipeg Jets. Over to the Eastern Conference in the, the Metropolitan Division. Flyers and Penguins, if you're going to watch one series in the playoffs, make it this one. Battle of the Keystone State is always a delight. I'm not sure it'll live up quite to their 2012 series, which was won by Philadelphia and featured some crazy final scores like 8-4 and 10-3 and stuff like that. I think that home ice will prevail here. Pittsburgh will get by in 7 games over the Flyers. Columbus. That's the problem when I write C-O-L there. Columbus Blue Jackets against the Washington Capitals. Blue Jackets have not won a playoff series in their franchise's history. In fact, I don't even know if they've even gotten to a Game 7 as of yet. In Washington, there's something about them. I don't know if it's just their playoff history or whatever, but they are starting Philip Grubauer, their backup goalie, in Game 1 because he's played a little bit better than Braden Holtby, who's been the starter for the last 5 or 6 years. That seems to strike me as a really strange move by head coach Barry Trotz, who I always say kind of looks like an amalgam of Billy Joel and post-stroke Vladimir Lenin. Columbus Blue Jackets in 6 games there. I like them to finally get over the hump. And the Tampa Bay Lightning taking on the New Jersey Devils there. New Jersey's kind of like Colorado. They're almost like the flip side of that. But Taylor Hall is just kind of a one-man band. Those two guys are probably going to be finalists for the Hart Trophy for most valuable player in the league. Tampa, ever since they brought in Ryan McDonagh on defense from the New York Rangers, I feel like they've looked a little bit out of sync, but I do think that they are going to pull it together somewhat, but it's going to take them 6 games to overcome the New Jersey Devils here. And then finally, the Toronto Maple Leafs against my Boston Bruins, and I will be in attendance for all the home games of this one, including a ridiculous 8 o'clock start on Saturday night. Thank you very much, National Broadcasting Company, for that one. I think Toronto won three out of 4 against the Bruins this year. They won all 4 games against the Bruins last year, although the Bruins were a completely different team last year than they were this year. I just think that Toronto is too fast for the Bruins' defensive unit. They are too well coached. Mike Babcock, one of the better coaches in the National Hockey League. I think that Bruce Cassidy will be overmatched, as he's a guy who has coached 6 home playoff games and his teams have lost all 6 of them. And I know this because I was in attendance for all 6, for the 03 Capitals and the 2017 Bruins. So I may go a little crazy during this playoff series, so I'm probably just going to stay off social media for a little while. I like Toronto in 5 over the Bruins, and the Bruins will lose all 3 home games and slowly drive me insane. And that is your NHL playoff preview for round 1. And that'll do it for this week. As for next week's show, I don't have anything planned, and in fact, I might take a week off. I've done this show for 61 consecutive weeks, and it's just me. So I think I might want to take a week and maybe recharge the batteries and see if there's anything out there I can do in terms of a show going forward. I still have that long queue of shows to do that I have, although some of them have been removed from YouTube. So don't be surprised, don't be alarmed if there's no show next week, just because of the fact that I paid for SoundCloud for another year. So damn it, I'm going to get my money's worth for it. So, you know, just take the opportunity on Thursday when you might download my show to give a download to our Vantage Point or to the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing or to the many shows on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, Worldcast, and all the other ones that have dropped over the last week or two. So, you know, give those a listen as well while I recharge my batteries and suffer horribly as the Bruins go down to defeat to the Toronto Maple Leafs and just make my life completely miserable. Maybe the Baltimore Orioles will win a game or two between now and my next show. Who knows? I mean, maybe there'll be no hit. I don't know. So it's slowly making me crazy. So I'm going to wrap it up here. So do tune in next time for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
what are you saying?
I'm saying that the spit could not have come from behind. That there had to have been a second spitter.